even though we enjoy it and truly appreciate winning these games and being in these moments, at the end of the day, we want to win that big trophy at the end of the year, and that's our goal.
We're not going to be able to get everybody back in here. Just go home, check your cell phones. We'll put the schedule on there. We'll see you tomorrow. There is a meeting tomorrow. I have no idea.
2:00. Fresh off of a championship Sunday weekend, we know it is going to be a rematch of Super Bowl 57 and Super Bowl 59. The NFC champion Eagles are taking on the AFC champion Kansas City Chiefs. We will see a three-peat attempt in a Super Bowl for the first time ever. I understand there's considerable Chiefs fatigue out there. And guess what? You got two more weeks of it. Kansas City Chiefs are the AFC champions again.
So I've been hearing from a lot of people that this annual theme we have at Hope, 52 for 25, 52 frequently asked questions of faith that we'll be digging into every time we gather for worship. People are really enjoying this. The question, the really big, important question we'll be talking about today is how and why are the Kansas City Chiefs the greatest dynasty in the history of the National Football League? Okay, Chiefs fans, we better cheer like that for Jesus in a little bit. That's not the question we're going to be looking at. But this dynastic run by my favorite team offers some pretty helpful illustrations as we are thinking about the real question for today, which is, what is church? The Bible reading is from Matthew chapter 16. Jesus is the coach, and he's been recruiting players for his team. They're called disciples. And at this point in the story, Jesus has been with his disciples for several years. This is kind of close to the end of Jesus' 3 years of public ministry. So they've been watching all the miracles that Jesus has been doing. They've been seeing his healings. They've been listening as he is teaching, as he is proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. And the disciples have been trained by Jesus to go out and do the kinds of things and say the kinds of things that Jesus is doing and saying as well. So now, after they've been together for all of this time, Jesus is wondering, what are they thinking? What are his disciples thinking when they think about him? Who do you think I am? Jesus asks. And Peter responds really quickly. You are the Messiah. You're the Son of the living God. And I want us to read together how Jesus responds to this declaration of faith from Peter. We'll put it on the screen. Let's read it out loud together. Those of you in the reservoir, read this out loud with us too. Upon this rock, I will build my church, and all the powers of hell will not conquer it. So I became a fan of the Chiefs when I was 9 years old. And I went with my dad and my Uncle Bob and my two brothers to Kansas City to our first game at Arrowhead Stadium. Dad had a Plymouth Horizon. You remember Plymouth Horizon? Just these tiny little, and we put the seats down in the back, and my two brothers, no seat belts, just blankets and pillows, and we just had a blast going down there. For the first 35 years that I was a fan of the Chiefs, they won 4 playoff games. Didn't even make it close to the Super Bowl. Then 7 years ago, Patrick Mahomes became the starting quarterback. And at the end of that year, 2018, the Chiefs played Tom Brady and the New England Patriots. The winner would go to the Super Bowl, and everybody wanted the Chiefs to win. Because 7 years ago, the New England Patriots were the villain, Spygate, Deflategate. Everybody wanted somebody, would you please conquer the horrible, terrible New England Patriots? 7 years later, the tables have turned. Now everybody has got Chiefs fatigue. Everybody wants somebody besides the Chiefs to win because people just can't appreciate greatness anymore. No, that's not what's going on. So, back to the Bible. Jesus, part of what he's doing with his disciples here in Matthew 16, he's saying, we're in the middle of a competition. There is an enemy that needs to be conquered. And Jesus wants the church to do it. So this is Lutheran Church of Hope, and I just want to be as clear as I can possibly be. Our competition is not other churches in town. We don't exist to conquer the Catholics or the Presbyterians or the Methodists. Our competition is not the Ridge. It's not Heartland Assembly or Keystone Church. Our competition is hell, and Jesus wants us to partner with him to put hell out of business. It's really interesting when you look at what Jesus is doing here. and we start using language like this, we better be precise because words matter. Definitions are important. And so let's look at the larger context of what's happening in this story. This part of the story actually begins in verse 13, which tells us there is a location where all these conversations are happening, and the location matters. This conversation is taking place in the region of Caesarea Philippi. What do we know about Caesarea Philippi? Well, if you go back to the Old Testament, you'll read about King Jeroboam. King Jeroboam becomes king after David, after Solomon. There's a civil war. The country can't figure out how do we live together as one? How do we live together as a united monarchy? And so it becomes divided. And now Jeroboam is the king of the north. Rehoboam is the king of the south. Jerusalem is in the south. And Jeroboam doesn't want his people to go to Jerusalem, to that foreign enemy territory, to worship at the temple in Jerusalem. So he builds his own temples in the north. He builds his own shrines to pagan gods, and he encourages people to worship these idols, and a lot of this idol worship is taking place in the region of Dan in the north, north of the Sea of Galilee, about 25 miles, really close to the border of Syria. Because of the divided nature of the kingdom, it becomes weaker and weaker and more susceptible to attack from outside enemies, and that's what happens. Here come the Assyrians, here come the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians, and eventually Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire conquer this region and they rename it. They make it the center for the worship of the Greek god Pan. They rename the place Panaeus. Eventually the Greeks get conquered by the Romans, and the Romans appoint a new king for this territory. His name is Herod. Herod has four sons. One of them is named Herod Philip, and Herod Philip renames the place in his honor, Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea in honor of the Caesar, the Roman Caesar, Philippi in honor of himself. If you were to go to the Holy Land today and go on a tour, this is one of the places where you could stop and learn about the history, what happens in Caesarea Philippi, what's going on, why does it matter that Jesus goes here in Matthew chapter 16. There's this massive rock formation with a cave, and there's water flowing out of it, and it ends up becoming the Jordan River. In Jesus' day, everyone believed, not everyone, the people who weren't part of the Jewish faith believed that this cave was the entrance to the underworld. And the underworld was ruled by the god Hades. And there were a bunch of gods and goddesses living in the underworld. They were fertility gods and goddesses. And they believed in the springtime, this is what the people believed, all those fertility gods and goddesses would journey from the underworld and return to earth to bring life to the earth in the springtime. I want to keep this sermon as PG-rated as possible. But I wonder if you can imagine what sort of practices might go along with the worship of fertility gods and goddesses who bring new life to the world. If you were to go to New Orleans during Mardi Gras or the red light district of Amsterdam, it would be like a Disney movie compared to the detestable practices that were associated with the worship of the fertility gods and goddesses at the pagan shrines of Caesarea Philippi. And this is where Jesus brings his disciples. And in the original Greek, this is what Jesus says: upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. In Jesus' day, this cave was referred to. Everybody knew this as the gate of Hades. In 2019, I got to go on a tour of the Holy Land, and we didn't go to Caesarea Philippi, but we did go to a different Caesarea. Caesarea by the sea, by the Mediterranean Sea, about 25 miles north of Tel Aviv. And this was built by a different King Herod to try to impress the Caesar. It becomes an important port for trades and goods and the economy. And it was a really impressive kind of place. There's an amphitheater there. There's the remains of a hippodrome, like this racing kind of coliseum. There's the remains of a prison where the Apostle Paul was imprisoned before they sent him to Rome. Our tour guide, Stav, was showing us King Herod's swimming pool. And Stav said Herod would often invite his enemies to come to Caesarea. He would wine and dine them and then say, hey, you want to go take a look at my infinity pool looking over the Mediterranean Sea? And then he would assassinate them in the swimming pool. Herod was not a good guy. When we finished the tour, we had to go through the gate of Caesarea, because in the biblical world, you would build a massive wall around your city to protect your city from outside invasion. And the only way in and out was through the gate. So you see the metal gate there, but what I hope you notice is in front of the gate, there's this, I don't know, semicircular shadow there. That's a gap in the wall. And what they told us was the soldiers would stand on top of the wall, and if the enemy breaks through the gates, they would pour boiling oil on the soldiers through that opening, or they would drop metal iron spikes to try to impale the soldiers. Kind of cool, huh? So here, what's the point? In Jesus' day, gates were defensive structures. In Jesus' day, you would use a gate to protect you from an attack, an invasion by an enemy. Which makes what Jesus says here really kind of interesting. Upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Now, in my Bible that I preach from, this passage, it says, Jesus says, I'm going to build my church, and the powers of hell will not conquer it. That's not the most helpful translation. Yes, make no mistake, there is a power of hell. There are evil forces at work in our world. Jesus says their purpose is to steal and kill and destroy, to rob us of life. Jesus wants to give life, and there's an opposite force that's trying to rob us of life. But it's a very different thing to say I'm going to build my church and the powers of hell will not conquer my church compared to saying I'm going to build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against my church. One puts the church in a defensive stance. We are under attack. We need to protect ourselves from the attack of the enemy. The other puts the church in an offensive stance. And that seems to be what Jesus is saying to his disciples here in Matthew 16. I'm going to build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. In other words, Jesus is saying, you don't need to be scared of the big, bad, evil world. I want you to go. I want you to be on the offensive. I want you to attack. I want you to storm the gates of hell. Because far too often in Jesus' day and in our day, it seems like hell is winning. It feels like hell is winning. Anytime somebody turns to drugs or alcohol to medicate an internal pain, hell is winning. Anytime a mental health crisis causes someone to become convinced, I'm all alone. I'm unwanted. My life doesn't matter. Hell is winning. Anytime a student gets bullied or belittled, or a child goes to bed with not enough food in their belly or not enough support and no real hope for the future, hell is winning. Anytime somebody decides to settle for the illusion of intimacy by turning to pornography and creating a secret life of shame and ultimately a culture, a society of shamelessness, hell is winning. Anytime we use gender or race or ethnicity to devalue, to demean, to destroy, hell is winning. Anytime a lie gets told, every time the truth gets trampled, hell is winning. And Jesus says that's not acceptable. And it shouldn't be acceptable to the church of Jesus Christ either. Jesus says at the end of Matthew's gospel, before he ascends back into heaven, after his resurrection, he says to his team, he says to his disciples, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, therefore go, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. In Acts chapter 1, verse 8, Jesus says, you'll receive power. He says this to his disciples. You'll receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you, and you will be my ambassadors, my witnesses here in Jerusalem locally, but ultimately to the ends of the earth. This authority and this power that Jesus has, he gives to the church. Why? So we can say, I think our church is doing pretty good compared to other churches in the denomination. So we can meet our budget, so we can run programs, so we can, I don't know, build buildings and make sure they are full? No, that's not why the church exists. The church exists to partner with Jesus in putting hell out of business. And the way we do that at our church is through the mission and vision. The mission of this church is to reach out to the world around us and share the everlasting love of Jesus Christ. And our vision is to be a church powered by the Spirit, to bring Christ to all cultures, revive the world with God's love, and make heaven more crowded. So it's really important for us when we start using language like this, when we start talking about attack, storming the gates of hell, putting hell out of business, let's be precise. Because again, words matter. Definitions are important. Last fall, we did an entire message series based on one chapter in the book of Romans. Romans chapter 12, which begins with a warning to the church. Do not conform to the behaviors and patterns of this world, but let God transform you. Part of what Paul is doing in Romans chapter 12, he's reminding the church the Jesus way is always a countercultural way. The way of Jesus is almost always going to look completely the opposite of the way of the world. And when we start talking about enemies and conquering in the world, there's a particular direction that we start to go, and Jesus has something different to say about enemies and conquering. You keep reading through Romans chapter 12, and it says, don't conquer evil with more evil. But that's what we like to do. That feels good to us. We like revenge. We like retribution. That's the way of the world. And the biblical writers make it very clear. If you're seeking revenge and retribution, it is a sign of a very weak, immature faith. Don't conquer evil with more evil. Conquer evil with good. Let's read together what Paul writes to the church in Corinth. This is in 2 Corinthians. It's up on the screen again, wherever you are. Let's read this out loud together. We are human, but we don't wage war as humans do. We use God's mighty weapons, not worldly weapons. Yes, Jesus wants us to storm the gates of hell. But what weapons does Jesus want us to use? God's mighty weapons. And what are those? As you think about how you might answer that question, I want to show you what some members of the Kansas City Chiefs were doing leading up to their Christmas Day game against the Pittsburgh Steelers. Take a look.
Hey, so we're continuing in our series called Courage to Climb, and this whole series is built around the tedious act of step-by-step climbing a mountain. And the whole point is that when you climb a mountain and you get to the top, it's not about staying at the top or living at the top. It's about being a person who is courageous, who just loves climbing.
I work really closely with the players and coaches to keep them encouraged spiritually throughout the season. Giving some guidance, some prayers, some hope, and also messages throughout the year that help them in their personal lives as well as their professional lives.
And so when you think about how God created us and how he made us different than all of creation, God made humans to be relational, and nothing else in this world is relational in the same way that human beings are. It's all about brotherhood.
Faith has been a big part of my life growing up. For me, it's like a family. Football is my big family, and being able to just come in here and make somebody smile or make somebody forget about how hectic their day is. Just that culture that you can bring and have, making sure you have family and faith within it can kind of brew this culture where everybody's kind of together and everybody really relies on each other.
This is not a sermon where I'm trying to convince you the Chiefs are also the holiest team in the National Football League. Every team in the NFL has a chaplain, and they have players and coaches who are committed, devoted to learning day by day, what does it look like for me to mature in my faith as I follow after Jesus? I just don't watch videos made by the media departments of other teams. I watch videos made by the media department of the Chiefs. And so when I saw this, I thought that fits in perfectly with what we're talking about today. What is church? The Marcellus Casey, the chaplain, he says, remember, God created humans to relate to one another in a very unique way, a way that's different than any other part of creation. And Trent McDuffie, the all-pro cornerback, says, I think of faith as a family, that we're learning how to work together side by side, to rely on each other. And that's church. And it gets to this phrase, each other, one another. It's a really important phrase that the biblical writers use more than 50 times to try to help us understand in this new movement, this Jesus movement that becomes the church, How are we to treat one another? How are we to relate to one another? And so we read things like welcome one another, be kind to one another, stir up one another to good works, share one another's burdens, serve one another, live in harmony with one another, forgive one another, comfort one another, show hospitality to one another, pray for one another. And that's just 10 of the more than 50 times we get clear instruction, clear teaching on the relational reality of the church. The New Testament writers use metaphors all the time to help us understand the relational reality of the church. The church is the body of Christ. It is the bride of Christ, the family of God, the community of faith. Over and over and over, they're trying to use language to help us internalize so that we can ultimately externalize, so we can live out this relational reality as followers of Jesus, as the gathered community of faith, the ecclesia, which is the church. Church isn't really being the church unless we one another. And all of these very specific instructions around how to treat and relate to one another fall under a larger umbrella of love. Jesus, the coach, the night before he is betrayed, is having a meal with his players, his closest friends, his disciples. And he tells them, I want you to love one another the way that I've loved you. That the world will know you are on Team Jesus. The world will know you're my followers. The world will know you are my disciples by your love for one another. God's mighty weapon is love. Love is what puts hell out of business. Love is the weapon we use as we storm the gates of hell. I want us to look at a word that is going to be a familiar word to you, but we don't typically spend a lot of time unpacking this word that shows up in the Bible. It's the word covenant. And covenant points to a unique, a special kind of relationship. The kind of relationship the word covenant points to is a partnership. That part of what it means to belong to the church is to understand I'm working together in partnership with God. I'm living my life in partnership with God. It's like we're teammates working side by side to accomplish a goal, to win a victory. At the beginning of the year, we looked at the creation account in Genesis. God creates the heavens and the earth, and God says, it is good. And part of what it means to be human beings created in the image of God, we partner with God. Anytime we see something that is not good in our world, something that could be better in our world, we partner with God to bring about more and more goodness in the world. But there's something about us as human beings. Relationships are hard. Partnership is hard. And instead of one anothering one another, serving and comforting and praying for one another, we find ourselves frustrated with one another. Man, why can't people see the world the way I see the world? Well, why can't people just do what I think needs to be done? If everyone would just do what I think, then all the problems in the world would magically disappear, right? And we have this kind of attitude in lots of different relational realities in our life. It shows up in marriages. It shows up as we parent children. Shows up in friendships. It shows up at work, even people who work in churches. I don't understand why they don't do things the way I think we should do things. And it shows up in our relationship with God. We get tired of waiting for God to act. We take matters into our own hands. And that's what happens in the creation account. Instead of living together in partnership with God, humanity decides, let's create this world according to our own terms. And the relationship with God gets broken. And the Bible's explanation for why our world is stuck in so much injustice, corruption, tragedy, and death is because of this broken partnership with God. We'll talk more about that next week when we explore the question, why does God allow suffering? It's easy for us to look back at the beginning and just point fingers and blame. Well, this is all Adam and Eve's fault. They sure messed things up for the rest of us. But it's not just them, it's all of us. All of us in our own unique and special ways have broken our partnership with God. We've decided to go our own way. Keep reading in the Genesis account. After creation, after the fall, after sin enters the world, we see God starting to form special relationships with a select few people, and these relationships are called covenants. We're going to look at four covenants that show up in the Old Testament really quickly. But as we look at each covenant, I want you to keep in the back of your mind, what is God's purpose? What's God's intent when God enters into a covenant? God makes a covenant with a few people so that God can renew his partnership with all people. So again, the creation story is all leading to day seven, where this is God's vision, where God gets to live and dwell together with all of God's creation. And everything God does is trying to get back to that original vision. So God makes a covenant with a few people so that God can renew his relationship, his partnership with all people. First covenant is with Noah. After the flood, Noah and his family are saved because they obey God. They build the ark and they get on the ark. And after the flood, God enters into this covenant with Noah. He says, listen, I understand humanity will not be able to be faithful. At its heart, humanity is unfaithful. But God promises, even though you won't be faithful, I'm going to be faithful to you. God makes that covenant with Noah. I'll never destroy humanity the way I just did. Then God enters into a covenant with a guy named Abraham, and God says to Abraham, I'm going to bless you, I'm going to give you a family, I'm going to give you a land where your family can flourish, and all you need to do is trust me, Abraham. And the promise of God to Abraham and his family is through you, through this one family, all families on earth will be blessed. You can read about that in Genesis 12. The next covenant is the Mosaic covenant. The family of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, they wind up slaves in Egypt. God sends Moses to deliver them. And on top of Mount Sinai, God gives Moses the law and the commandments, which are basically one way to sort of summarize all the law and the commandments. These are God's guidelines for living together as a covenant community. And again, the idea behind this is that if God's people would follow his commands, everyone around them will look at them and say, there's something special about the way they relate to one another that we like, that we are attracted to. Final covenant is with David, King David, sitting on the throne in Jerusalem, and God enters into this covenant with him. God says, you and your descendants will rule on the throne with justice and righteousness. Justice and righteousness. Again, if you read through 2 Samuel and 1 Kings, the books of the Bible that talk about the reign of King David, you'll see that phrase over and over. David ruled with justice and righteousness. And God promises that one day, one of David's sons would sit on the throne and would enlarge this reign to include all nations. This blessing of justice and righteousness would this son of David would rule all nations. And again, there's something about us as human beings. When we get chosen, when we believe we're part of a few people who have a special relationship, there's something about what it means to be human, our brokenness as human beings that says, oh, well, I guess that means I'm more important and I'm better, that I matter more than everyone else. Instead of using this relationship, this blessing, to be a blessing to others, we just kind of keep it to ourselves, hoard it to ourselves. That's what God's people end up doing. And there's all sorts of ways that they end up breaking these covenants. A large part of what's going on when you read through the prophets in the Old Testament, the prophets are giving us specifics. Here's how this partnership with God got messed up. Here's how the covenant got broken. Hosea says, there is no faithfulness, no kindness, no knowledge of God in your land. You make vows and break them. You kill and steal and commit adultery. There is violence everywhere. Remember the Mosaic covenant, the law and the commandments, the Ten Commandments. Don't lie, don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery. They're breaking them all. And so part of what Hosea is doing is observing the brokenness and the corruption in the religious life of God's chosen people. Amos has some observations as well. Amos says, how you hate honest judges, how you despise people who tell the truth. You oppress good people by taking bribes and deprive the poor of justice in the courts. So Amos' observation is the justice system, the courts are corrupt and broken. He goes on in chapter 8 to make another observation. Listen to this, you who rob the poor and trample down the needy. You can't wait for the Sabbath day to be over and the religious festivals to end so you can get back to cheating the helpless. The financial world, the economic system of the people of God is broken and corrupt. Isaiah chimes in. Isaiah chapter 10, what sorrow awaits the unjust judges and those who issue unfair laws. They deprive the poor of justice and deny the rights of the needy among my people. Again, it's the lawmakers, it's the government, corrupt and broken. Ezekiel summarizes the whole thing this way. You have not taken care of the weak. You have not tended the sick or bound up the injured. You've not gone looking for those who have wandered away and are lost. Instead, you have ruled them with harshness and cruelty. The covenant God makes with King David is to rule with justice and righteousness, and instead, they're ruling with harshness and cruelty. They've broken the covenant. And because they refuse to live in partnership with God, God's chosen people are conquered by enemies. They are forced off their land. They lose their homes. They wind up in exile in foreign countries. And everything feels hopeless. And then here comes the word of the Lord through some of the Old Testament prophets, delivering a message of hope. Yes, you broke that old covenant that God made with you, but the day is going to come when God's going to make a new covenant with you. And God's going to give you a new heart, and God's going to put a new spirit in you. And one day Jesus is born. And we're told Jesus is from the family of Abraham. That Jesus is the one who's going, all nations on earth will be blessed. All families on earth will be blessed through Jesus. We're told he's of the house and lineage of King David, that Jesus is the one who can sit on that throne and rule with true justice and righteousness. Jesus himself says, I didn't come to abolish the law of Moses. I came to fulfill it. Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man. He's a human being, God's perfect partner that humanity was supposed to be, but we failed to be. And Jesus refers to himself as the Son of God. That through Jesus, God's partnership with all humanity can be restored. And so Jesus says, follow me. Follow me. Join my team. Be a part of this new covenant community that is the church. Now, the church is not going to be perfect. Jesus doesn't expect us to be perfect. He expects us to be faithful, and Jesus is committed to helping us grow and become more and more faithful all the time. This is what he does for Peter. Peter gets a lot of things right, and he gets a lot of things really wrong, just like you and me. And Jesus promises he's committed to helping us become more and more faithful all the time. So Peter says, you're the Messiah, you're the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, that's right, and upon this rock I'm going to build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. It's like the greatest pregame talk any coach has ever given. And Peter's ready to run through walls for Jesus. Let's go. Let's attack. And then you get to verse 21 in Matthew 16. And Jesus says to his disciples, I'm going to be arrested, I'm going to suffer, and I'm going to die. And Peter doesn't like that. Time out. I thought there was a foe you wanted us to vanquish. I thought there was an enemy you wanted us to conquer. I thought you wanted us to partner with you and storm the gates of hell and put hell out of business. And Jesus says, yes, that's the plan. And my ways are not your ways. And my thoughts are higher than your thoughts. So let me be clear. Let us be precise as I give you the game plan. What is the strategy for the church as we storm the gates of hell? Here's what Jesus says. Let's read this out loud together. We'll put it up on the screen. Read it with me. If any of you wants to be my follower, you must give up your own way, take up your cross, and follow me. Jesus doesn't take up worldly weapons. He takes up the cross. And out of perfect sacrificial love for you and for me and for all people, for the entire world, Jesus beats the grave. He conquers hell. He puts hell out of business, and he invites us to join him, to get into the game, to get onto this team, find your place on this team. and work with Jesus together as the church, as the body of Christ, as the family of God, to love one another the way Jesus has loved us. One more clip from the chapel service of the Kansas City Chiefs, and then we'll celebrate communion together. Take a look.
You gotta have a lot of faith when you play football. It takes a lot of faith to prepare a group of men to believe in you and be able to trust in what you say.
There's another step in our journey, man. There's another step in our journey.
Whatever goal you got set for them, that they believe that you guys can achieve that.
These guys are very young, and they're put into some very powerful positions as far as like needing to perform on a high level at their peak in front of thousands, if not millions of people. It's a really high pressure situation. I believe that it's something that really makes you question a lot of things, think about a lot of things, and really need to like reach higher to something that is greater than yourself that can help you on a day-to-day basis with the pressure that you're facing.
I want y'all to be locked in with each other, need each other, rely on each other, encourage each other, build each other up, and to have a love for each other that lasts beyond this career, beyond this season. I pray that tomorrow, as you get on that field, that that is what would encourage you. Being with your brothers one more time. Let's pray together.
Jesus doesn't break covenants, he keeps covenants. And he does it with a love that lasts, a love that is eternal, a love that is costly.